my guys are still under a judicial estrangement order. That blue thing I got from her.
I've got the best lawyer soft tacos can buy.
Objection.
On what grounds?
How about silliness, Your Honor?
I think legal terms are magic words that can force people to do what I want.
My client has instructed me to remind the court how rich and important he is, and that he is not like other men.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 423. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, Andrew?
I'm doing fantastically well.
Doing better this episode, much happier than the last one, I assume.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't get much worse, so.
And you can't do better than having Randall Eliason on as a guest.
So. Absolutely. Can't wait to get Randall on. In the meantime, the spreadsheet, it says, upcoming, Alan Dershowitz has lost his several expletives and then mind. Care to explain?
Yeah, I think we can safely keep our clean rating and say Alan Dershowitz has lost his goddamn mind. Alan Dershowitz has filed a $300 million libel lawsuit against CNN for portraying him as, quote, an intellectual who had lost his mind, end of quote. And
not related to the Epstein stuff? I just assumed that's what it was going to be.
Oh, no. It relates to CNN's commentary on Alan Dershowitz's analysis of the Trump impeachment. This lawsuit is the kind of thing that you would file only if you had lost your mind. So Alan Dershowitz, remember, Opening Arguments is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, a Maryland limited liability company. I hope that you will be suing us as well.
So it's the only lawsuit that can offer itself as evidence. It could be like, well, you may please the court, we submit the lawsuit that we're here for.
May it please the court, Alan Dershowitz hired a Florida personal injury attorney to file a $300 million defamation lawsuit against CNN for saying accurately that his legal analysis and arguments made during the Trump impeachment were nonsense, which they were, right?
Yeah.
It's great and crazy. And I want to quote from paragraph 8, right? This is from the allegation, defamation, libel and slander. I'm quoting from the middle of the paragraph, quote, following the airing of that clip of Dershowitz's testimony. Over and over again, the hosts, together with their on-panel guests, including CNN employees and paid commentators, exploded into a one-sided and false narrative that Professor Dershowitz believed and argued that as long as the president believes his re-election is in the public interest, he could do anything at all, underline, including illegal acts, and be immune from impeachment. The very notion of that was preposterous and foolish on its face, and that was the point, to falsely paint Professor Dershowitz as a constitutional scholar and intellectual who had lost his mind. Again, Alan Dershowitz is a constitutional scholar and intellectual who has lost his mind. And if you want more analysis on that, you're going to have to wait for an upcoming episode of OA.
All right. Wow, that's about as fun a preview as it gets. I'm excited for that.
What I hear when I'm being yelled at is people caring loudly at me.
All right, Andy, we've got an anonymous listener question here. They say, hi, I was wondering if you could cover on your show if Trump's now known to be purposeful misinformation campaign in February/March could qualify as second degree manslaughter as defined by New York law. I realize a key factor would be the case law informing defining recklessly, which I have no idea how to find. Feel free to skip if you think this is too hot, polarized a topic. Yeah, right. That's never why we skip anything, anonymous listener. Okay, what do you think, Andrew?
I wanted to answer this for a couple of reasons. Obviously, no topic too hot for OA.
Yeah.
We should, you know, produce 1990s style 1-900 commercials for that. But we've gotten a lot of these kinds of questions, right? We still have not really done a deep dive on the Trump-Woodward interview. I don't know that we need to, right? Like, there's not a lot. I think the political consequences are more serious than the legal consequences. And so this was really illustrative of a lot of the legal stuff that came in, which I understand the predicate of the question, right? The predicate of the question is, hey, the president of the United States knew that COVID was bad and went on television and didn't just say, oh, it's not going to be that bad, but disparaged, ridiculed and belittled people who said it was going to be that bad, engaged in a series of hyperbolic and ridiculous statements, encouraged people to undertake quack treatments, right? Like, acted in such a way that if he were not the president of the United States, right, if he were the president of Pfizer and these were all in connection with developing a COVID vaccine, this person would be under indictment. Right. So that's the gravamen of the question and lots of other parallel ones. It is, as I said, a sensible and well-meaning question for that. And I love the reason I picked this one out in particular is because
they tried to start doing a little homework on it.
Well, and not just trying to start doing homework, but I think the reason they said under New York law, right, is because they were looking for state law, right?
Like, yeah.
He was in the state of New York, made that, right? So no possibility of Mike Pence pardoning him for this, right?
Well, also, and wouldn't it just be that there isn't federal manslaughter law?
Sure. Yeah. but might
also
be other.
But also not pardonable. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. I mean, it may be both, but I'm choosing to vest our listeners when thinking like multiple chess moves ahead of like, you know, let's get them on state law crimes, right? So New York Penal Law Section 125.15 says a person is guilty of manslaughter in the second degree when he recklessly causes the death of another person, right? Okay. And it's a Class C felony in New York law. So is Trump guilty of that? Super clever. It does not have anything to do with the case law informing or defining recklessly. I think that
who would have standing and in what state would this apply? If he's the president, would it be in any state where there is a victim allegedly?
Well, the question for standing purposes would be where Donald Trump was when he made the statement, when he engaged in the plans and the actions. And knowing that he spends an awful, right? And it's either going to be one of three places, right? It's either going to be Trump Tower in New York, Mar-a-Lago in Florida, or Washington, D.C. And you could look and find the parallel statutes in D.C. and Florida. And what the court is going to do is undertake a totality of the circumstances test to figure out which state has the closest connection to the crime and therefore which state would be able to indict him if there were a crime that were committed. But sadly, there is not. The president enjoys absolute immunity for all actions undertaken as president in furtherance of his duties as president. We talked about this a little bit in last episode
about
the E. Jean Carroll
issue. We've been talking about this for 4 years. The remedy is impeachment. The remedy is impeachment.
Yeah. And look, if you could arrest a president under state law for undertaking an action as president that recklessly caused the death of another person, then the Republicans would have had the state of Alabama arrest Barack Obama over Benghazi, right? Yeah. Obama and Clinton, right? Like, being president means making life and death decisions. Being president and being a thoroughly dishonest, corrupt game show host means incompetently making life and death decisions. But the level of competence is not what, right, is not what our criminal justice system evaluates. So there's nothing there must be political consequences for this. If there are no political consequences, there are no consequences. So again, goes heavily in with our theme. of this show, right? If you think there should be political consequences, then impose them on this president. And that means going out and voting Biden-Harris. It's the only thing you can do. Yeah. And it doesn't matter. You know, we can say this every single episode. We're going to keep saying it until the second week of November. Well, to the our Friday episode on the first week of November, which hopefully will be a very, very happy episode. There are, if you think, all of these are things for which there must be political consequences, and you cannot simultaneously be angry and want to impose political consequences and not want to vote for the Democratic ticket. So there you go.
Sorry, everybody. Yeah. So no gotcha on this one. That's unfortunate, but it's consistent with what we've learned on the show over these past four horrible years.
And again, we're going to be talking, lots of people have asked, hey, what's opening arguments going to do in 2021? And the answer is, right, we're going to hold Joe Biden's feet to the fire. We're going to cover eminent domain. We're going to cover state laws. Like, we're going to do all the stuff we've continued to do. One of the things that I've hinted at that I
can I just, I really, sorry, yeah, as if there's any worry, who out there right now is thinking, geez, what will OA do if things are just too great in a few months? I have no, that's the furthest from my mind is things are going to be just too good to even have a show. Like, yeah. First off, that would be awesome. I'll take it. I would trade the show for not the, you know, eugenics that's happening on the border and all that.
Yeah. I could go back to practicing law full time, right?
And all, you know, all, you know, I could, I got stuff. I can, you know,
you have skills, you have things, marketable skills. Yeah. One of the things that we're going to do is we're going to cover the kinds of reform that are necessary to help protect against Trump again. Right. Yeah. And so there are lots of people that are going to be out there that are going to be proposing, right? Like all of those proposals are going to start with Trump did this. Let's make it illegal for future presidents to do this. And that's not a bad starting point. But I do want to say with this that changing the rules to allow presidents to be criminally liable for the consequences of their political decisions, no matter how stupid or poorly intentioned, would be a terrible reform, would be instantly hijacked by the right and used to stymie every future Democratic president. So
so that wouldn't be even on your list of things
it would absolutely not be something that I would want. Right. Like what you do is you don't elect deranged game show hosts as president.
Yeah, there's your remedy.
There it is. So clever, good thinking. But that's why not only is it not against the law, it shouldn't be against the law.
Great answer. We really appreciate the question, though. Thanks for sending those in, everybody. It's good stuff. Down. 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 And we are joined again by Professor Randall Eliason. He's got the new Great Courses course out. We promised we'd have him back to talk about that. And here you are. How are you doing today, Randall?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me back.
No problem. We always love having you on the show.
Thanks. Hey, can I ask you a preliminary question before we get started, though?
You'll have to direct it to my attorney, Andrew Torres.
I was curious, Thomas, when you stopped being an inquisitive interviewer and became a comedian.
Yeah, don't on advice of counsel, Dunn, I'm instructing him not to answer that.
Oh, that's how it's going to be, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
It's going to be one of those depositions. Okay.
Well, referring to the change in the intro, that was something that was that way. And then even going back, the description of the show had it the comedian way for the whole time. So it wasn't, I just changed them to match. And the reason is because I just think that it's a way better elevator pitch to be like, hey, we got a lawyer and a funny guy together. That's what's understandable. 5-second pitch. Having to be like, we got a lawyer. I mean, there's a guy. He's just, he asks questions. He's no qualifications. He's just kind of there, but he asks questions and hopefully they're good ones. And that just, I don't know. It's easier to just give the 5-second funny guy and lawyer thing.
Plus, the implication that I'm not funny means that on the rare occasions
I was going to say, we have a lawyer and Lord knows he can't be funny, so we need a funny guy.
It's like twice, yeah, it's twice as good. So
yeah, your entire identity is just lawyer. It's distilled down to that.
Oh, it's I knew what I was doing when I went to law school. Like, never have another. But we have somebody on whose identity is both lawyer and now great courses instructor.
Yeah.
So talk to us about your course.
Yeah, well, thanks. I really appreciate you having me on. Appreciate the opportunity. So I'm pretty excited. You know, if you're familiar with great courses, basically their thing is they take courses by professors from around the country and put them on a video format. So people who don't have the opportunity to go to that school or are out of school, you know, can basically attend the course by watching the videos. And there's a guidebook that goes with it. And so this is the course is called White Collar Criminal Law Explained. And it's basically the white collar crime class that I teach at GW Law School. And includes 24 30-minute lectures, video, and then a 240-something page guidebook that goes with it. And you can buy the DVDs, or you can stream it and watch it online, or you can just get the audio if you want to just listen to it in your car and not watch me on video.
A, that sounds amazing. B, Great Courses has sponsored this show, but like, we love Great Courses. So, and C, obviously, you know, this is your 500th appearance on the show. Like, you have a gift of being able to explain the law, that we love and recognize. So, tremendous match on all of those. Why don't we kind of start with the basics just for the audience? Like, how would you define white collar crime?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's actually sort of the topic of the first lecture, sort of what is white collar? And, you know, the term is pretty interesting because if you go to the criminal code, for example, you know, and try to look up the section that's titled white collar crimes, you're not going to find anything. it's not an official definition. There is no one official definition, and the term. Well,
yeah,
itself,
you have to do the secret handshake, and then they give you the other law book that has those.
The term itself has its roots are actually in sociology, not law. So it comes from a sociologist named Sutherland back in the 30s, and he was arguing. He defined white collar crime as crimes committed by a person of high social status in the course of their profession, respectability, and high social status. And he was arguing. Sociology against sociology theories at the time that said crime is primarily caused by poverty and desperation and is primarily a problem of the lower classes. Mm. And he said, look, there's this whole area of crime committed by people who are not impoverished. Mm. They're well off. They're, you know, wealthy and powerful, and they commit crimes anyway. And you're
look, get in a time machine, travel forward to 2017, then come back, and this sociological theory will be obviously false.
The reason Trump commits so much crime is his hard scrabble upbringing.
Exactly. So he said you're not accounting for this type of crime, and he called that white collar crime. So he was focused on the nature of the offender, sort of white collar executive, right? In criminal law, one of the first things I have to tell my students is the name white collar crime is kind of a misnomer because it sounds like you're talking about a type of offender, like a white collar person, right? Mm-hmm. But in criminal law, we're actually talking about a type of offense. So because in criminal law, criminal law doesn't differentiate when we're defining crimes based on the social class of the offender, like a poor man who commits Medicaid fraud to get the medicine he needs to live and a doctor who commits Medicaid fraud to buy a new Lexus. They both commit the same crime in terms of the elements of the offense and what the government has to prove, right? They'll be dealt with very differently in terms of, you know, should they be prosecuted at all and what charges would be appropriate and what sentence and all those things, but it's the same crime. So for criminal law purposes, white collar is not talking about a type of offender. It's talking about a type of offense, no matter who commits it or, you know, or the class of the person who commits it. And like I said, there's no official definition, but the definition that I use in my class is white collar crimes are nonviolent illegal activities that use fraud, deceit, deception, concealment, or some other kind of misrepresentation to get money or property or some other advantage or to cover up other wrongdoing. Because there's also this category of white collar crimes, perjury, obstruction, false statements that we call cover up crimes to sort of conceal some underlying misconduct.
Would you restrict your definition with respect to the underlying misconduct as well?
In a cover-up crime?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, and you know, this is something that came up a lot during the Mueller investigation. Cover-up crimes don't have to be, you don't have to be concealing an underlying crime, mm-hmm. right? You know, there's that old saying, the cover-up is worse than the crime, I think arose during Watergate, maybe.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a flawed saying for a couple reasons. First of all, the cover-up itself can be a crime, right? and then secondly, what's being covered up doesn't have to be criminal. It could be politically embarrassing, for example. So we heard a lot during the Mueller investigation, one of the arguments of Trump and his supporters was, if there was no collusion, which also is not a crime, if there was no underlying, there was no underlying criminal activity with the Russians, how could there be obstruction? You can't have obstruction unless there's an underlying crime. And that's just nonsense. You can have obstruction to conceal things that would be politically embarrassing, things that would be personally embarrassing, things that might be financially damaging, even if they're not criminal.
Let's go down that bit of a rabbit trail for a second. It strikes me that it is very likely common to have those kinds of cover-up crimes in the business world as well as the political world, right? Like you would want to cover up various business dealings, whether or not the underlying dealings are illegal. Is my intuition, again, not my area of practice, so that's truly not meant to be a softball question. I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I guess I don't know if you could generalize. I mean, to me, it actually feels like it's more common in politics that, you know, a politician is going to have more likely to have a reason to conceal something that just might be politically embarrassing or damaging, even if it's not criminal, just because it's going to hurt them in the next election. And so, you know, you tend to see a lot of cover-ups in political corruption cases, like Scooter Libby is another example.
Mm.
If you remember that case, you know, they were being investigated for leaking the CIA agent's name, Valerie
right.
Plame.
And right.
it turned out that wasn't a crime, at least not a provable crime by the person who actually did it. So no one got charged with that crime, but Libby gets charged with the cover-up, with lying to the FBI and the grand jury about his role in it. So, you know, cover-up crime of activity that was ultimately itself not determined to be criminal. Not at all uncommon.
Yeah, I think Trump pardoned Libby recently.
He did, just recently, yeah.
Yeah.
So my working definition of white-collar crime was crime that people do with impunity and never get punished for. Am I wrong in that?
No, but it's true that they are harder to prove, harder to detect, and harder to prosecute. And let me talk a minute about that if I can. The key distinction between white collar and what you might call street crime or violent crime is in a street crime like a robbery or a homicide or something like that, you generally know a crime's been committed, right? You come home and your house is broken into and all your electronics are gone. Or, you know, there's a body on the street with 12 bullet holes in the back. You know there's been a crime. And in a case like that, the key issue is usually who did it? Can we figure out who did it and then prove that beyond reasonable doubt? And you can prove that by observable events, things that witnesses can see, you know, eyewitnesses or physical evidence, you know, like fingerprints or, you know, surveillance cameras or DNA or whatever. But you've got objective, you know, evidence or things that can be observed that you can use to prove that case. In white collar, it's frequently flipped. In white collar cases, frequently we know who did it and we know what they did. For example, in a big Pentagon fraud case where it comes to light that some company overbilled the Pentagon by $10 million, okay? So we know we're going to have all those bills, all those invoices, all the emails back and forth, all the contracting documents. You're going to have this huge paper trail. You're going to know exactly who did what, who submitted the bills, how much they overbilled the government. None of that's likely to be contested. The key issue in that case is going to be why. What was going on in their heads? The question of intent.
Mens rea?
Yeah, exactly. Because the difference between a fraud, a crime, and just a mistake all has to do with what's going on in their heads. Because the company's going to say, well, yeah, we overbilled them, but it was just a mistake. It was an accounting screw up. We've got this new software. You know, we're really sorry. Of course, we'll pay the money back, but there was no intent to defraud. And if the government wants to prove that's a crime, you've got to prove what was going on in their heads. And that's a lot harder.
Well, one of the things that I've said on the show, and I'm happy to have you pick a fight with me if you think I'm wrong about this, because you see that element of specific intent required on a lot of the political crimes, right? Required when dating way back to when we first discussed Hillary Clinton's emails, right, in episode 13, that the specific offenses related to disclosure or failure to secure classified information all had that scienter or specific intent requirement to it. And that while it is that's a high threshold and it's hard to prove what's going on in someone's head, I took the position that it's not an entirely different area of criminal law, right? That there are plenty of offenses that we think of as street crime kind of offenses, right, that nevertheless have a specific intent requirement to that. It makes them harder to prove, but it's a difference, you know, it is still a commonality across both, you know, white and blue collar crime.
Yeah, for sure.
Agree or disagree? Yeah, okay.
Well, it's a great point. Agree to an extent. So, of course, mens rea is an element of every crime, like you said, right? And we learned that in the first year of law school. We've always got to show the bad intent. The difference, I'd argue, is that in a street crime or violent crime case, although intent's an element of the offense that's got to be proved, it's usually not the primary issue, and it's usually not that much in dispute. If I walk up to you and stick a gun in your face and steal your wallet, you know, my intent to rob you is not really at issue. Or the intent of the person who broke into my house and stole all of my electronics, their intent to commit a burglary is not the key issue in the case. It's going to be pretty obvious. But in white collar, intent is usually the key issue. And so, again, because we can't read minds, that's what makes the cases so much more difficult to prove, because you're dealing with conduct that otherwise could be lawful.
Mm.
You know, unlike an armed robbery or a burglary or a homicide, you know, many white-collar crimes involve actions that could otherwise be lawful. And the only thing that's going to make them criminal is my intent. I can take my laptop and throw it in the Potomac River. Okay. I've got the right to do that. Now, maybe I risk a littering citation, but other than that, that's not a crime. Okay. If I do the exact same thing, but now I'm doing it because a grand jury has subpoenaed the files on my laptop, now that's an obstruction of justice. And the only difference in that crime is what's in my head.
That's an excellent point. And it is related to an area where I think you've written a lot, both for the Washington Post and on your Sidebars blog, specifically about the Bob McDonnell case before the Supreme Court and sort of the status of our current bribery laws. Right?
Yeah,
it's a different element, right? The point you were making in the McDonnell case, 9-0, you know, rare display of bipartisanship from the Supreme Court, had to do with the definition of an official act. But it seems like the same analysis applies, right? Which is, we expect in politics that socializing, entree, chumming around, like having, you know, the person that you introduce and in pre-COVID days, shake hands with at a cocktail party, that kind of behavior can be perfectly legal, right? We expect absolutely. That all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's all over the McDonnell opinion. You know, the court is worried about criminalizing routine constituent services, routine political interactions. You know, unless we have a really high threshold for proving criminality, that it would chill all of these otherwise perfectly legitimate activities, chill legal campaign contributions, you know, and so we need to set a really high bar. You know, even a better example than McDonnell for this point is Menendez.
Mm.
If you remember the Bob Menendez prosecution, you know, he's basically Senator Menendez prosecuted on a bribery theory for this Dr. Melgen, who was flying him all over in his private jet back and forth to the Dominican Republic and showering, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions and PAC contributions and things like that. They're charged with bribery. And again, kind of an example of what I was just talking about, when that case goes to trial, there's no dispute about the facts, really. There's no dispute about all the plane trips, all the campaign contributions, all the money that changed hands, all the things that Menendez did for Melgen. The defense is no corrupt intent. The defense is, yeah, we did all these things. And yeah, I took all those trips, but we've been friends for 20 plus years. We're lifelong friends. We've gone to each other's kids', you know, baptisms and weddings and birthday parties, our families vacation together. And so all the stuff he gave me was out of friendship. And, you know, yeah, he's rich, so they're pretty nice gifts, but they were out of friendship, not because of some corrupt deal. and all the things that I did in Congress were in my capacity as a senator pursuing public policy that also happened to be, you know, things of interest to him. Jury hung 10-2 for acquittal. You know, so again, the facts are undisputed, but the question of corrupt intent is what drove that case.
So I think the lesson there is don't elect public servants who have rich friends, right? I realize that's a little bit of a laugh line, but like I mean that seriously in the sense that it seems like, right? And I love us going to the Bob Menendez case, right? Like that's he's a Democrat as opposed to Bob McDonnell, who was a Republican. So, you know, corruption certainly is a bipartisan game.
Yeah.
And we don't need to take sides on that. But I would sort of summarize your point on Menendez as being that somebody could be, you know, kind of honestly believe in the con men and frauds that they've surrounded themselves with. And you're 100% correct, right? That like, yep, that the remedy for that is electoral, right? Like if we elect, you know, we're going to elect, you know, QAnon supporting lunatics, to this coming Congress in 2020. And like, they're going to push QAnon conspiracy theories, right? Like not because they're being bribed to do so, but because, God help us, they legitimately believe that stuff. And I guess I do agree with you that there's sort of this is not an area where the criminal law was meant to help protect us.
Yep, right? Yep. And that's another, you know, that gets back to a point we've discussed on the show before. And that's a common theme in white collar. I think we talked about it with Bridgegate, for example, you know, when people are kind of outraged, you know, look at how bad this misconduct was. You know, it was just horrible what they did. It was reprehensible. And the response in white collar is frequently, yeah, it was, but it's not criminal, right? Or at least it doesn't violate the federal criminal law. We're not saying it's okay, you know?
Well, hold on. You know, we've kind of switched. Is this not criminal, or based on how you've set up this framing, is it just a matter of we cannot prove the contents of someone's brain?
No, in Bridgegate, it was that it wasn't criminal, that the conduct that the prosecutors charged as fraud didn't fit the legal definition of fraud. Now, you could amend the statutes. Congress could amend the statutes to change that, but that didn't turn on their intent. That turned on what's a fraud.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify because we were kind of talking mostly about intent initially.
Yeah.
And I didn't, and especially with Andrew saying like, well, the remedy is electoral. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, if we're talking about the bribery and these things that I think we all kind of know are crimes, but it's often just a question of like, well, we can't quite prove what's going on in their mind, you know, then to me, it's not so much that the solution is only political. It's that maybe we need to think about the burden of proof a little differently. And I wanted to ask you the question, is this just something that is inevitably set up for unfairness? Because if we look at one, you know, I don't know, I was going to say class of crime, I'm not sure what to say, but one type of crime where it's like, you know, as you've already outlined, often the mens rea is not really at issue, or it's assumed if you're, you know, robbing someone, it's kind of assumed you're robbing someone. There's no, not a lot of intent usually going on there. And then the other type of crime where it's all about intent, and it just so happens that the people doing it tend to be people of privilege, tend to be people that will societally receive the benefit of the doubt a lot, you know? Yeah. So it just seems inevitable that it's going to be like, well, oh, look at that guy. He does. Sure, there. You know, I guess if you knew what was going on in his mind and you knew that it was evil intent, then sure, maybe it's a crime. But look at him. He's, you know, doesn't seem like such a bad guy. Whereas other people who might be less fortunate would often not get that benefit of the doubt. Is unfairness just kind of inevitable in that?
Yeah, there's no question that's a factor. I think but if you think about the nature of the crimes, you know, again, it has to do, I think, with the fact that we're often talking about conduct that could otherwise be legal. Mm-hmm. Right? It's not sort of not inherently or obviously criminal. And so to some extent, there's a real trade-off. You want there to be kind of a high bar to prove some of these types of cases so that you're not routinely criminalizing conduct that, you know, is actually lawful. And that's really a lot of white collar is all about. It's about trying to draw these lines and courts wrestling with trying to draw the lines between what's a fraud and what just may be super aggressive or sleazy or you know, underhanded or something less, because we're talking about not kind of black and white crimes like assault and murder, you know, and robbery. We're talking about things like fraud and corruption, and the parameters are fuzzier.
Sure, but doesn't it feel like maybe in that balancing act, it's gone a little too much toward one direction, or is that just the last 4 years of Trump that is making me
say that? I think I would agree with that, especially in the public corruption space. That there's been a whole series of court decisions in the last 20 years that have narrowed public corruption laws so much that, you know, including McDonnell, that they've gotten really, really difficult to prove. But there's a solution. Congress could come in and amend the statutes. It's not an unsolvable problem. You know, the laws against bribery could be reformed.
Opening Arguments is brought to you by Policy Genius. I know you already know this, of course, but September is National Life Insurance Awareness Month. You're telling me, Thomas, I already have the float made. I'm already celebrating the awareness of life insurance for National Life Insurance Awareness Month. I know. But just in case you're one of the few who didn't know that, now you know. And with everything going on, some people aren't aware of whether or not it's even possible to buy life insurance right now. Well, it is possible. It's still easy to shop for life insurance. It's something I did a couple years back. I've been telling you that every time that we have this ad because I'm still happy that I did it. And if you have loved ones depending on your income, you should as well do what I did and get life insurance. Here's how you do it. Head to policygenius.com. In minutes, you can work out how much coverage you need and compare quotes from top insurers to find your best price. Step 2, apply for your lowest price. Step 3, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork, all the red tape, and that's it. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance company. So if you hit any speed bumps during the application process, they'll take care of everything. They even have policies which allow eligible customers to skip the in-person medical exam and do it over the phone. That's the kind of service that has earned Policy Genius a 5-star rating across over 1,600 reviews on Trustpilot and Google. So, if you need life insurance, head to policygenius.com right now to get started. You could save $1,500 or more a year by comparing quotes on their marketplace. Policy Genius, when it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right.
We've talked about this multiple episodes of the show, but I think it is... If history has taught us anything, right, and maybe it hasn't, immediately post Nixon, we got a variety of acts of Congress that, while sort of watered down, were meant to, you know, if you want to be cynical, you know, lock the barn door after the horse had resigned in disgrace. And I think it's a safe bet.
See, who says you're not funny?
There we go.
That's hilarious.
I think it's a safe bet.
The show that pairs a comedian and a comedian to talk about the law.
We don't care what anyone else says, Andrew. We think you're funny.
Thank you. And you didn't even add looking after it. Usually that's what people do. All right. So look, Biden wins in 2021. Let's say it's a blue wave, right? Let's say the Democrats narrowly recapture the Senate. We have a, you know, unified Democratic government. I think very clearly at the head of that list are going to be all sorts of efforts to try and do the same thing, right, that the post-Watergate Congress did, right? Craft new laws meant to address the political corruption that we just saw. Yep. So two questions on that, right? The first is, do you have thought, right? Like you just said, we could reform the bribery statute, right? So do you have thoughts on some obvious, easily obtainable, you know, broadly applicable and appealing reform cases? Do you have thoughts on what Democrats might be tempted to do but would be a terrible idea? I mean, I got a whole bunch, so yeah. I said two questions, but why don't we start with those two? Like, what would be a good idea? What would be a bad idea?
Well, my reforming the bribery law is my favorite sort of pet project. I mean, just going in.
I might have set you up there.
18201, you know, to sort of undo McDonnell, clarify the definition of honest services that was scaled way back in Skilling, and just give prosecutors back some of the tools that they used to have under those statutes to go after a broader swath of political corruption, where I think still criminal prosecution is appropriate, but the bar has just gotten so high that, you know, nobody but the most sort of clumsy, obtuse, dumb politician is ever going to end up getting convicted.
So what would that look like?
Well, like I said, you could amend the definition of official act to make it broader than what the court said in McDonald's, so that something like what McDonald did, basically McDonald exercised the power of his office to benefit his benefactor, right? The guy that was mm-hmm. showering him with gifts. That should be enough, right? It doesn't, instead of this very narrow sort of legalistic definition of official act, you rewrite the statute to say something like exercising official power or official discretion in exchange for the thing of value, you know, to broaden the scope of what could apply. Because the key, you know, I mean, the court talked a lot about, oh, we don't want to criminalize routine constituent activities and things like that. You know, this guy was not just some donor who had contributed to McDonald's campaign. You know, he flew him around the country on his private jet. He gave him $170,000 in secret gifts. These weren't legal campaign contributions. And so, you know, I'm not overly concerned about deterring that kind of activity.
So does that suggest maybe that we should reconceptualize bribery as not kind of move outside the quid pro quo framework, right? Because I'm thinking about the counterexample, right? Which is, let's suppose it's not going to happen, but let's suppose, you know, I render sufficient. I do volunteer for the Biden campaign, but like, you know, let's say he names me to his legal team and I become one of his head legal analysts and I work really, really hard to get Joe Biden elected. And then he pays me back in 2021 by appointing me to the federal bench, right? That it seems to me that that's what the Supreme Court is trying to protect, right? And we could have a public policy discussion on, you know, should you be allowed to name your friends and people who help that? But assume for the sake of argument that there is a good there, right? That we would want, I do this with the best of intentions. So we want, you know, hypothetical Andrew Torres who volunteers for the Biden campaign and then gets paid back by, you know, being named to the federal bench or attorney general or whatever,
As long as it's Andrew, I think we're fine with it.
Right, but that's a quid pro quo, right? I did a thing of service for the Biden campaign, and he explicitly paid me back by doing a good thing for me. But not a corrupt quid pro quo.
That's right. That's just what I was going to say. The key in all those types of hypos is they leave out the element of corrupt intent. So there's political log rolling sometimes.
Yeah, right.
People exchanging political favors like that. That's just the fact of life in politics. That's not considered corrupt.
But I will point out that what struck you and what I think is intuitively persuasive to the audience, the evidence of the medical company exec, and I forget his name, the person who gave, you know, McDonald's wife the fur coat and
Johnny Williams.
John, I, how could you forget John Williams? Right, such a, not that John Williams.
Dang, but, yeah, John Lee, huh?
So Williams, right? In coming up with evidence of his corrupt intent, you immediately point to the Ferrari, the fur coat, the boat ride, the monetary gifts. But it seems like there is a leap of logic. I don't think any of the three of us on this call are wealthy enough that we give out Ferraris and fur coats as gifts to friends. But I could imagine, right? Like it's not implausible to think that, yeah, well, I sometimes give what are for me lavish gifts. Right? Like I bought my brother-in-law a sous vide machine for his birthday, right? Like that was a lavish gift coming from, you know, coming from me. If I were a millionaire, it would not, right? It would not. So I guess it's a winding question of saying if the intuitive evidence to both a prosecutor and potentially to the jury of corrupt intent is the nature of the thing itself, then maybe intent isn't the word that we're looking for. Like maybe we're just saying there's some things you ought not to do to public officials, right? Like you shouldn't give them money. You shouldn't give them fur coats.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's not just the word intent. It's the word corrupt, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so there can be plenty of gifts that are not corrupt. If you've got the long-term relationship, which is what sort of Menendez and Dr. Melligan argued. And when it comes to politicians, there are a lot of mechanisms in place, you know, disclosure requirements, Ethics in Government Act forms, things like that, that are supposed to sort of shed sunlight on these gifts. And, you know, there are limits to legal campaign contributions and things like that. So there are a lot of rules in place where you can distinguish, you know, what might be legitimate gifts from corrupt ones. And like I said, the thing with Williams and McDonald was it was all done in secret.
Mm.
An issue in the Menendez case was, you know, he's supposed to report these plane trips on his Ethics and Government Act forms, and he didn't.
Yeah.
And so that was part of the government's evidence of corrupt intent. You know, it didn't persuade the jury. He argued that it was an oversight, or some attorney told him he didn't have to, you know, he had a defense. But that was part of the evidence of corrupt intent, was that there are mechanisms in place to disclose these gifts. And if you follow those, then you're presumptively not being corrupt.
So do you think strengthening the mechanisms could work, right? Like adding, you know, for avoidance of doubt, failure to disclose is presumptive, you know, creates a rebuttable presumption that, you know, you've engaged in corrupt intent, something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if you could do a rebuttable presumption in criminal law, but...
Well, that's the civil lawyer in me thinking it. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm sure there's room to strengthen some of these disclosure requirements as part of your basket of reforms, you know, reforming the bribery laws. I think there should be a move to try to put some kind of, if not laws, you know, regulations or something in place to prevent the politicization by the Department of Justice. You know, there's been so many norms that were kind of unwritten norms, but had been followed and understood since Watergate about justice, you know, resisting political interference in prosecutions. And of course, it was never perfect, but it worked pretty well, you know. And that's just been completely shattered by the Trump administration and Barr. And so, you know, now people are starting to think, okay, we can't rely on norms and people's good faith anymore. We better put something in place that has some teeth, has some kind of sanctions if people do this again. So hopefully there'll be some efforts in that regard as well.
Couldn't agree more with you on that. From somebody who's been in on the inside, right, that we see externally, right? We just talked about on last Friday's episode, we talked about, you know, Barr's directive to tell AUSAs that they should be, you know, prosecuting protesters for sedition, right?
Yeah.
And you know how preposterous that is. And I said that line prosecutors have, you know, not just the requirements of the job, but also various canons of legal ethics that are going to prevent them from just, you know, filing nonsense claims. But you know what? Internally, I mean, how much pressure, how much autonomy is there? I mean, am I expecting too much of a prosecutor when, you know, when your boss says do X? I mean, you know, all of us are certainly familiar with, you know, well, the boss wants it this way.
Yeah. No, you're not expecting too much. That's the way it has to be. And that's the way it historically has been, at least during my time in DOJ. And I think when you see the thousands of people who signed, you know, former prosecutors who signed the letters protesting Barr's actions, I mean, you can see how widespread that sentiment is. It's not just me. That's the job, is to do the right thing. Your job is to try to make sure that justice is done, not just to win or just get an indictment or pursue political opponents or do something you know is improper just because your supervisor tells you. And that's the norm that's just really been stretched and tested by Barr. And we've seen, you know, I mean, honorable prosecutors in the Stone case and the Flynn case, you know, they withdrew, they resigned, yeah, rather than follow those kinds of orders. And that is the job, and that's the honorable thing to do.
But the problem with that is, right, that in the long run, that leaves only the toadies and lackeys behind, right? If the remedy is resign, yeah, you know, yeah, that's what we're left with.
But, you know, there are your personal ethical and moral requirements, and then there's the big picture problem, right? So for, like you were saying, for the individual prosecutor, there does come a point when you have to choose what's right over sort of keeping your job.
Yeah.
If you're going to adhere to the sort of professional norms that we expect, then the bigger problem is, how do you get rid of the bigger problem? You vote them out, right? You've got to vote them out and get an attorney general in place who believes in these norms.
Yeah. Although we've seen voting is an imprecise remedy in the best of times, you know, particularly when you're talking about voting out in an electoral college system, a president who appointed an attorney general who's head of an executive branch, right? Like that's a pretty deep, I mean, it seems to me that there's a strong argument. And look, I make the argument on the show all the time. In the A segment on this very episode, I make the argument that there are some things that are just not criminal, just not judicial remedies, right? The remedy is political. If the thought process is that the political remedy for a corrupt attorney general seems pretty attenuated, then is there hope for creating some levels of independence at DOJ, right? Like, I know, obviously the CFPB decision from this last term at the Supreme Court is going to be a barrier, and the past, you know, five years worth of Supreme Court decisions on independent executive agencies, I think create a tough minefield. But is there a way to say, hey, no president campaigns on, right? I mean, not even Donald Trump said, I'm going to get into office and my attorney general is going to be a toady who prevents anybody from prosecuting any wrongdoing that anybody in my administration does. So it seems like it's hard to hold somebody politically accountable. Is there something you can do to help insulate the DOJ now that, those norms are shattered, right? Like Thomas's favorite, that there was a campaign ad cut about the 30 seconds that Bill Clinton spent on the tarmac with Loretta Lynch.
Those were the days, huh? Wasn't that
right? Yeah,
that was.
So, what can we do to restore some semblance of independence in case of Bill Barr 2.0? That I was wrong. I've been wrong about a lot of stuff on the show, but my saying I didn't think Bill Barr, was going to be a disaster is probably, my biggest mea culpa.
I'm right there with you. I wrote a whole blog post about it.
Yeah.
When he was first appointed, I said, "Oh man, the people that think he's just going to be a Trump lackey, they're going to be disappointed. He's a serious guy." I said, "Man, when I blow it,
right, definitely don't put that one in your ad for your great course. I'm just saying, skip that
one. Well, I wrote a subsequent post about how wrong I was, so I kind of made
it. I'm just teasing. We like accountability and honesty. It's good.
Yeah, it's really hard because, of course, the attorney general is part of the president's administration, right? So this all kind of flows from the top, and the culture is set at the top. And so there's obviously other political remedies like impeachment, that are available in really extreme cases, but we've seen how well that really works. I don't know, short of, really pushing to put someone in office for whom these norms really mean something, that are really important, and that will work to restore the integrity of DOJ that I think has been so severely damaged over the last few years. That's going to be a big job. It's going to take some time to crawl back out of this hole that has been dug in the last few years.
Yeah, I worry about that. Well, I can't emphasize highly enough, right, part of the theme of this show, part of why we love having you on, to begin to understand, to propose societal remedies, right, and new policies, new laws, new norms, right? It helps to understand what the existing laws are. And so I'm going to go listen to the course, and I would encourage everybody else to do likewise. How should people find it?
Thanks. So you can go to thegreatcourses.com and look for White Collar Criminal Law Explained. Like I said, you can stream it. You can buy the DVDs if you want. And the thing I wanted to emphasize is it's not just for lawyers by any means. I mean, the course is geared towards non-lawyers, like your podcast, right? I mean, the part of my goal is to explain these things to non-lawyers and try to make them, more understandable. So when we see things in the news, people can have a better understanding of what's going on. So I appreciate the opportunity to come on. I'm pretty excited about it.
Absolutely. We're so happy to hear about it. Glad to have you on. Everybody, go check out that great course. Thanks again, Randall, for coming on the show. As always, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you!
And now it's time to thank our top patrons, our Hall of Famers, our all-time greats on patreon.com/law. I'm sure they're enjoying all the great stuff. Oh, and the early episode that you're hearing right now. I always do Sundays. I call it Sunday's episode because for me, I release it Sunday night. Everybody else gets it, we'll exaggerate it, but they get it on Tuesday. Even though it's Tuesday at midnight, but still.
Yeah, but that normal people go to bed.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you get it way early. But anyway, why don't you start us off, Andrew?
Yeah. Thank you to Matt Rogers for Virginia 47th House District, At Casa Agria is the best brewery. At Emperor's Brewery is a close second. Stoic Paralegal. Yeah, that's an important characteristic. Great Dooku Tree. Thomas Kleberg. Bradford Katie. Mary Perez. Shout out to my friend in Indy that just passed the bar on her first try. Well, you know, no associate at this firm has ever failed the bar exam, so good work. And Veteran Suicide, trailtozero.org. Re-elect Senator Doug Jones. Yeah, if that happens, that would be amazing. If you're young and healthy, please volunteer to be a poll worker at powerthepolls.org. That's all one word. And I have gone to that site. It's a reputable organization, nonprofit, will help you staff your local polling place. Please do that.
Nice.
I unicycled 110 miles in New Jersey and New York, and all I got were lousy jokes about how I should be listening to podcasts. Wow. Two fabulous lesbians who just bought a house. Well, now we're going to have 6 months of congratulations to fabulous lesbian house. But that sounds amazing. Congrats on your house.
Look, I'd like to think that were it not for COVID, you know, Andrew, you and I would have been invited to all these big milestones. I think, you know, the wedding, the open house, you know, like.
Maybe they'll do a Zoom call open house and we can send them a video picture of a plant. So it'll be fun. William Drew Collins, Bob Newhouse, Sassy Italy Tours is not going to give Steve Bannon a refund on that Grappa tour he's not going to be able to make now. By the way, I'm interested in a Grappa tour. That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Greg Kreimer, the McGann MacGuffin Egg McMuffin. Followed hilariously by the great Transformers reference. First we crack the shell, then we crack the nuts inside. Register every person you know to vote. Yes, do that. Mongo and Duchess 2024. Wearing a Trump hat voids my respect for your religious beliefs. Cheeky Breaky. Jennifer Schakowsky. Join Scientology to go clear. I like going totally clear. Don't join Scientology. Mike Hall. An old, mad, blind, despised, and dying king. That Dickens, always with the compliment. Yeah, that is a Red Dwarf reference. Fly like a hot dog, Freedom Eagle. Say it with me, amicus. Ugh. Angry Macface, Matthew McConaughey portraying Matthew McConaughey. Teacher going back to school, mask on, fingers crossed. Yeah, please do your best to stay safe. You're in a plague factory. Stop. Ask a question a president of Finland would ask. Center, Black Trans Sex Workers. The Books That Burn podcast, reviewing fictional depictions of trauma since 2019. Postal Police, stamping out crime since 1775. Love that. Vote early if you can. This episode brought to you by the letter Q for quarantine. Great, like QAnon nuts are going to be on our radar now. We're on their radar. No joke this week, just a sincere thank you for all you helped to do, for all you do to help this timeline make sense. Oh, thank you so much. My favorite paradox is the legal advice. Don't take legal advice from a podcast. It's not legal advice. Change my Patreon name so that I don't jump every time you read it. Make Steve King an author again. We did that, so change your Patreon name again. Our British etiquette class is mostly about real proper tea. Murray Gregerson. In Illinois, we pronounce it Illinois. I move for a bad president thingy. Second. Can we have a second impeachment for old time's sake? Yes. Yes, we can. Vote early. Vote often. -infinity. Ian Buckley. Putting a pin in this patron name for later. Nice. Jake Braun. Not that Chris Wallace. I'm too sexy to vote Trump. Too sexy to vote Trump. Trump needs to be reimpeached. I'm a lawyer, and you know what I mean when I... And the rest of Right Said Fred. Christopher Brown, online law school with a third grader. What could go wrong? Lawful Copter says Bannon looks like a guy who just had his second to last Horcrux destroyed. GiveToModestNeeds.org. GiveToModestNeeds.org. The wheels of justice turn faster than the speed I changed my Patreon name. True. Support the co-op economy. Front row seats to the last U.S. Democratic election. Ugh. There's a goat. Why is there a goat? Andrew Seidel's butt made a plan for how to vote. You should too. Go to vote.org. Let me drink lots of water. I like peeing totally clear. Circle. Has anyone tried turning 2020 off and on again? Yeah. Odin wants you to vote against Donald Trump by voting for Joe Biden. Polly Hernandez. With a little white and dark night blue paint, a Trump Pence sign can be made to read, I pump penis. The previous patron name is true. The next patron name is false. Thomas Takes the Bar is not on Pornhub. Stocking up on lung injectable bleach, Emily Rainbow Spence, Mongo would be pleased to play Cheney to Duchess's W. Terry Cannon, one of the millennials killing the Kennedy industry, Jason Kopas, Hotspear.com, never meta legal advice he didn't like, punching fascists is not enough, get into good trouble. Take donation advice from a podcast, FFRF, EFF, ACLU Modest Needs, and our own damn Patreon. I've got a fever and the only prescription is more triangle and Nate Trex. Thomas, take it away.
All right. Thank you to Darth Mandy Pants. Does anyone have the instructions for changing timelines? Asking for a friend. V. Frank, 13th century Saxony gravel truck lawyer. Save the USPS. They're essential for small business and our democracy. Volunteer for your candidate today and take back your government. Jennifer Kratch, Diogenes the Cynic was right. Unionize Brooklyn friends. Jeff Galbach, sticks and stones may break my bones, but real property law can never hurt me. Wash your hands, then vote for Joe Biden. CivilPoliticsRadio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. Stephen Baltic, Kate Sandoval, John Bilderback. There are 6 weekends left to save the Republic. Give what you can, do what you can. If I've said it once, I've said it 1,000 times. Twitter gives the best legal advice. Philip Kaiser, Andrew the Arbitrary and Capricious, Eric Alsman, I like traffic lights, I like traffic lights, I like traffic lights. Stop equivocating, they are not the same. Vote Biden. Baseball law states 2020 doesn't count. If you like it, then you should have put a pin in it. No. I love that song. Actually, like, that's one of the few like pop songs from recent. Oh, it's not very recent, but I do love that song.
I'm with you that that's a good pop song.
It's a great, perfect pop song. Yeah, video's amazing. Good stuff. Do more of that.
There you go. We're pro Beyonce. We're pro Beyonce on this. Beyonce on this podcast.
But also pro that patron. That was a fantastic patron name. Nice one. Absion, stop, throw the grenade like a lawyer would throw. That was also an excellent one, but it needs an update. Pain Strumpet, Trambolus, Therese Chan, La Machine Infernal, The Wandering Gambler, A World Without Simile Wouldn't Be Like Anything. I support the Australian Republican movement. No, not those Republicans. SCOTUS uses Bob's Country Bunker model of religious tolerance. Milo Mead song is an uncle. I love you, Willa. Ah, congrats.
Aw.
Boston Live Show 2021 with lobsters and karaoke. Join your labor union. Together we bargain. Alone we beg. Just diagnosed with sleep apnea. I may have never not been tired. Gosh, I wish I had sleep apnea. Then I could feel like I was going to not be tired. James K. Ah, gravity, thou art a heartless B-word. Doctor at night, homeschooling our kids in the day. Pretty sure my wife's a superhero, all one word. Chad T, anonymous. The arc of the moral universe is Jeremy Baramy. That's a great one. WordOrigins.org, your source for legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Stop, ask a question T. Gomez would ask. Hope you are all safe and well. Have a good week. Closing concessions. Airbud 69, Manus Manum Lavat. What? Maybe the real emoluments violations are the bribes we received along the way. Liz witnesseth me weeks. Derek, can we get Elizabeth Warren to debate Trump, please? Adam Costa, Jay Aldenwalt, Big Easy Blasphemy. I guess some text art that looks like maybe boobs, or maybe I just have a problem. We'll see. But some parentheses and some periods, so it is what it is. A string of unpronounceable characters. Rhonda 2020 because WTF not. The coronavirus apocalypse is making me too depressed to think of anything clever this week. That's fair. My superpower is knowing the difference between Bill Pullman and Bill Paxton. Malaika Chandler, tricicular manslaughter, soggy pants. Matthew Vernon, adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Sakishite Fukusumi, didn't expect Nancy Pelosi to be our best hope of saving the Good Friday Agreement, but here we are. Don't take legal advice from laser beam monstrosity attorney at law. Heather L. Jeremiah's fancy microwave emporium. Ian and Ollie. David in Brooklyn. Danny Rosari. Eli Bosnick. Sam Danow. If 2020 were a transformer, it would be Canopy. You're going to have to tell me what that means.
It's the pile of trash transformer.
It's a pile of trash. That's awesome. Mitchell. No commute, so behind on podcasts. It's 42 days until election day. Have you voted yet? Vote, vote, vote. Well, 42 days. Sam Buck. Natasha Crunchwrap wants you to support the Justice Policy Institute. Philatelists support the USPS. And finally, Conrad Michaels,
woo!
Champion of all time. Thanks so much, patrons. We love you.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam. No kidding.
Okay, time for T3BE answer time. Let's find out if I have to work on some new music or something.
Yeah, Thomas, this was a great bar exam question. The Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, a man and a woman, both independent purse snatchers, entered into a grocery store and intended to commit crimes, and in fact did commit crimes. The man approached a victim, grabbed her purse, knocked her down, stole the purse, and ran out. And then the far more crafty woman just stole a different purse from a shopping cart that was unattended and ran out. But both were caught, and the question was, which of the two purse snatchers could properly be convicted of robbery? The man, the woman, both, or neither? And you immediately, well, I mean, with no hesitation, went to B, only the man. You actually struggled to come up with a scenario in which there could be a Thomas's second chance bar exam. Ultimately, you were like, maybe.
Well, also, could be, yeah, like, some weird rule of like, if there's already a ruckus happening and you commit a crime, then that's part of the, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. But basically, you were like, it's B because... only the man used force. Usually I give you my analysis of this, and it is, and I don't love, because they're designed for test-taking purposes, so I don't often read from the simulated exam's answer guide, because it's often not helpful for the kinds of public discussion we're having on opening arguments. Here, I want to read in its entirety from the practice answer. And by the way, they're usually like several paragraphs.
Yeah, each option will have like a couple sentences.
It says, solution, the correct answer is B. Answer option B is correct. Only the man can be convicted of robbery because only he used force to steal the purse. Answer options A, C, and D are incorrect for the same reason. So there you go. Case closed.
As straightforward as it gets. Case closed. Three in a row.
That's a hat trick.
You are correct. The best kind of correct.
He's not even a lawyer when he's kicking your ass.
Wow, I'm so pleased. I'm glad I didn't. You know, there is a risk of trying to overthink these things. And
no credit for me for using the hockey.
I want
language.
Sure. It's a real triple play. No, I was trying to do one back at you with baseball. Why don't you hop in your time machine now and tell us who is this week's big winner? Whoa, no one adjusts that dial. It's actually me in the time machine again, and I'm so happy because we've got a great winner. At metal_world_RPG on Twitter has a great answer. Thomas was correct in T3BE about the common law distinction between robbery and larceny. It follows what I hereby name the Olivia Newton-John rule. If a theft declares intent to get physical or actually does so, it becomes robbery. Well done. That's everything we want in a T3BE answer. It was good. It was right. It was funny. And it's a Olivia Newton-John rule. So throw Metal World a follow on Twitter. You know what to do. Give them the infinite fame and fortune. Definitely guaranteed. @metal_world_RPG. And that's it for our show. Thanks for listening. We will see you on Friday for a rapid response. And thanks to, of course, Randall Lyson for coming on the show. That was a ton of fun. We'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow @OAWiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.